Hear the full conversation and catch anything you miss at chapelboro.com/forum on the hill.
And welcome into the Forum on the Hill. Aaron Keck here with you at 97.9 The Hill Studios. We have come to the final hour of the Forum. We've had some amazing conversations over the course of the week, 9 of them. And again, you can, as you just heard, revisit all of the Forum hours on our website, chapelboro.com. If you missed them, if you want to listen back, terrific conversations with a bunch of fantastic people over the course of this entire week. And we have come to the final hour of the Forum, and so much of 2020 has focused on COVID-19 and its impact, and we'll certainly talk about that this hour as well. The other very large thing that's happened in 2020 that's taken a lot of our attention and captured a lot of conversation is the racial justice movement and the social justice movement writ large, especially as it relates to policing and public safety, which have had their own issues to deal with in the midst of COVID-19. So a lot to cover this hour as we talk about public safety and social justice. Over the course of this hour, we'll be joined by 6 different people in the studio. We'll have a few more in the second half hour, but this half hour, we are joined by Anna Richards, who is the president of the Chapel Hill Carbrew NAACP. Chapel Hill Police Chief Chris Blue is with us, and Emil Charles, also with us, UNC student who organized some of the demonstrations in Chapel Hill this summer, some of which brought out hundreds of people in our community and has been a leader in the ongoing conversation ever since. So, Anna, Chris, Emil, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, I don't know where to begin, but Anna, let me start with you. The racial justice movement in the summer raised awareness of the issue of disparities and systemic racism, particularly with regard to policing and beyond that in American society, to a degree that I think a lot of people maybe didn't have awareness. You certainly did, and we had a lot of conversations about that well before this summer. So what have you learned? What do you know now that you didn't know before this year began? Just from your perspective, what's different now?
Well, thanks for bringing us together for this conversation, which I think is really important. What I knew before this year is that Black and brown bodies were not valued to the same extent as white bodies in our country. And that was exemplified even more so as I think the nation witnessed a series of really murders that didn't make any sense. And so the thing that stands out for me about 2020 is because of the world in which we live, where we all watched those 48 seconds with George Floyd, and we heard and saw the Breonna Taylor confrontation and murder, that a lot of people, it was news to them. Mm-hmm. It was like, oh my God, this is, how could that happen? And so what I learned is that a compassionate community is there. It's out there. People came out. They showed up. What was disheartening about 2020 is that there were people who exploited the relatively low level of protest, I don't even call them protests, but disruptors who created mayhem, and how quickly some of that support dissipated as things got publicized and utilized to counter the messages that we saw early on and the support that we saw early on.
in terms of and the demonstrations that have happened in Chapel Hill have been peaceful, but the support dissipating, is that that's certainly something that we saw on a national level. Is that something that you saw locally too?
Well, I think the conversation changed. Mm-hmm. We certainly have experienced ongoing support, but we hear people in our conversation citing issues that aren't really issues here in Chapel Hill relative to demonstrations. But I think in many ways, as the summer went on and the number of demonstrations increased, people were increasingly concerned about what they were seeing on television, even though we hadn't had that experience here.
Mm-hmm. Emil, we spoke for the first time during the summer when the demonstrations were happening, and you were in with Nia Farrington, right? And,
yep.
And she said something in that conversation that stuck with me, which is kind of similar to what Anna just said, which is on the one hand, you've got this feeling of deja vu, because what we saw this year is nothing new. It's mm-hmm. different names, but very similar stories. And on the other hand, there's a sense of finally, maybe this time the movement is gaining traction that's going to stick and last. That was in the summertime. What are you thinking now?
Yeah, I think definitely in the summer, you said we saw hundreds of people out at protests. There were huge conversations happening in the community. And I think one of the differences between then and now is that perhaps people maybe aren't in the streets and we don't see those numbers, but there is so much action happening behind the scenes and things that people are doing that isn't always coined as maybe activism or efforts to, you know, to address issues like this. But those, I think, are certainly still happening.
Mm-hmm. What are you looking forward to, and what do you find to be like a challenge heading into 2021 in terms of keeping this movement going?
I think staying connected with those who are passionate about the issue, and continuing to hold dialogue spaces like this, continuing to reach those who maybe are interested but haven't found the right way to plug in. Mm-hmm. I think, being a young person who was organizing these protests, I learned that once you know how to plug in, it's pretty easy and you can continue to do that. But I think one of the hardest parts is jumping into that pool and learning how you may become an activist or you may start to create change.
Yeah. Chapel Hill Police Chief Chris Ballou, I know you're also no stranger to this conversation. We've had similar conversations in previous years. I've seen you at forums on policing reform, racial disparities in law enforcement. What is different for you now versus 12 months ago? What have you learned?
Well, I think both Anna and Emil hit the nail on the head. I mean, I think there are folks interested in the conversation that maybe had not always been interested in the conversation before, and that's encouraging. And I mean that not just in terms of community members, although there as well. You know, I'm cautiously optimistic and encouraged that I'm seeing law enforcement folks having conversations that they weren't having a year ago. I'm not so naive to expect that we're going to have sweeping change to every corner of our state or our nation right away, because as you and I've talked about before, many communities aren't having this conversation yet, and it's and including their police departments and their other law enforcement officers. But where I am encouraged is I'm seeing this incremental creep of really important discussions around use of force and disparities in low-level misdemeanor crime enforcement in jurisdictions that just never talked about it before. And more importantly, imagining those conversations will make their way into the legislature this year. Where they go, you know, we all have an opportunity to influence that. But I'm encouraged by that. And then I'm encouraged by some of the efforts. I mean, you know, in some ways, talk is cheap. Actually, in most ways, talk is cheap. So where I'm also encouraged is that a lot of the recommendations that I've seen come out of the governor's task force, or that other groups with which I'm associated have, and others are associated, that have thought about just smart reform efforts, a lot of those can be enacted at the local level without any legislative intervention whatsoever. So I think there's real opportunity for some of the momentum that has been underway locally around these very important issues to pick up steam, and with a new kind of community involvement too, because there are people at the table and who are emboldened to be at the table who maybe hadn't historically been like young people like Emil, and I really think that's critical.
Yeah, we talked earlier this year as well, and you also said something that stuck with me, which is there have been movements for policing reform in the past, most recently right at the end of the Obama administration, the 21st Century Task Force on 21st Century Policing that was moving the conversation forward or seeming to, and then that kind of fizzled out in the last few years. What is it going to take to keep this conversation moving forward in a tangible way that actually leads to positive steps and positive action?
I think it's local involvement.
Mm.
That's what I think. Communities holding their public servants accountable and engaging with them, too, and letting them know what they want out of their police departments. Early in my career, I had the benefit of working for a chief who said to me, you should police your community the way they want to be policed. And that has been a guiding philosophy of mine and our department always. Whether we always hit the mark or not is another question. But certainly the motivation to listen to the folks who are on the receiving end of your services, who pay for your services, and who are expecting and believing in you, by the way, to deliver those in a way that meets our community expectations, that's incumbent upon all of us. And for it to be successful, communities are going to have to continue to expect and demand it.
Anna?
Yeah, I was wanting to jump in there. Soon after George Floyd's murder, the NAACP organizations across Orange and Chatham County, their four branches, came together and developed what we're calling our 6-point agenda for law enforcement transformation. And once we put that agenda together, we met with all the jurisdictions. There are 9 between the two counties. There's a little piece of Mebane that makes up the 9th.
Mm-hmm.
But we have continued those conversations as recently as this week. We're still in dialogue. Our intent is to consolidate all that information and come out with some kind of report. But I would say that I've been very encouraged. So we have our agenda, the governor's task force, the sheriff's association has put forth some recommendations. The District 18 has put forth some recommendations. The police chiefs have association. So I would strongly agree that there is momentum at this point. Unlike some of the past reform efforts. And I think it really is up to the community to keep that dialogue going. One of the reasons we want to come out with the report is we want to develop some kind of way to track where we're moving to. In addition, both town councils have passed pretty strong resolutions around looking at how we can transform our law enforcement and improve safety for everyone. So those are the encouraging things that are going on here locally in Orange and Chatham County, and that I think it's up to us as a community to keep that momentum going.
Mm-hmm. I want to throw out this question to anyone, because I know all of you have studied this issue, and you're going to know a lot more than me, so anyone can take this question. There are 1,000 potential reforms on the table. Some of them are incremental, some of them are more radical. What do you see as being the most effective or the most necessary? And flip side, what reforms are being proposed that may not be particularly effective?
I'll jump Emil? In. If that
yeah,
okay.
Go for it.
I think we have to go where the data take us. And where we see opportunities for policy interventions in areas where you see the greatest enforcement disparities, that's where we should spend our time, I think. I mean, our council took some decisive action in the area of regulatory traffic stops late in the spring, and that's an area of great racial disparity. And they said, you all have made some progress, but progress is not enough. We want decisive action, and they took that action. And I think that's a really good example, and there are others. We know that low-level marijuana enforcement continues to be an area of disparity, even when we've worked very hard to try to address the disparity, and it has improved. But it's not where it needs to be. There's an opportunity there. If not you know, there'll be a legislative discussion about it. I don't expect it to go very far. But I think there's certainly some local opportunities to take a good hard look at how we handle marijuana enforcement, at least from a criminal point of view. Those are the ones that come to mind for me. And then I think also this idea of looking for ways to serve community members who, for whom a police officer ends up being the one who shows up in front of them, but for whom they might not be the right one. Just a quick stat, and then I'll let the others jump in. You know, we ran some numbers toward the end of the summertime, and about 50% of our calls for service in our downtown area were calls for service related to, somehow related to homelessness. We aren't the answer to that call, but people don't know who else to call other than 911 when there's somebody asleep on their doorstep of their business or cold on the bench in front of their store. And so we got to get serious about upstream interventions too, when there are very obvious persons in need in our community, and the cops aren't the right remedy for that problem.
Emil?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Chief Blue mentioned this, but looking at other people who can't help with those kind of situations, and I know that the department has a crisis unit that operates kind of outside of the department, and there are a few other things that are in the pipeline now. But for me too, one big part is thinking about who is being affected by policing most, mm-hmm. and making sure that those are the same people who are giving input onto these reforms and who are giving input into any advisory statements or councils that are being formed, because we know those are the communities that are affected.
Mm-hmm. Anna?
Yeah, so a couple things. One, I think a few years ago, you talked about some of the other reforms, and I think we all thought that body cameras were going to be the end all, right? Mm-hmm. If they just wore body cameras, then we would understand what happened. And what we've seen is that in some instances, all of a sudden the cameras aren't on. And then in some instances, as in George Floyd, they are on and people commit murder in front of the camera. And so one of the things that I think some of the reforms are trying to get underneath the cause, which is systemic racism in our society, and what is driving this behavior, I think really are, so a lot of the reforms that talk about who gets hired, how people are trained, how people are paid, and transparency, I think, is the other issue that it runs through a lot of the reforms and transformation that's being put forth. And then lastly, the decriminalization of poverty, and because whether it's homelessness or local ordinances that really are not criminal offenses in some ways. And to Chief's point, understanding the data. So we've made some progress in collecting data. A lot of the jurisdictions aren't really analyzing the data and using the data to guide their actions. And so that's kind of the next level that we need to get to on some of these things.
Say more about systemic racism, because we're going to be having this conversation this hour, and this is the conversation that's being had across the country in terms of addressing systemic racism, specifically with regard to law enforcement. Whatever reforms happen with law enforcement, it's still going to exist in this larger context where systemic racism is still just as present as before. So where do we go from
there?
So
whether or not we talk about, let's talk about why, it sort of gets to the why.
Mm-hmm.
So even when we talk about things that have a good sound to them, like community policing, mm-hmm. what does that mean? And if it ends up meaning over-policing of black and brown neighborhoods, so you have areas in town where people say they never see a police officer. And in other areas of the community, officers are frequently there. So why is someone with a gun in certain neighborhoods and not in other neighborhoods? And so the belief that there's danger is and that there's a need for control I think gets underneath some of these, some of the issues that we have. And so our, we understanding that history, understanding how policing started in our country, and understanding what's left from that legacy, I think is where we have to go to move forward.
Yeah. Chief, that's a really powerful argument about community policing. And I know not just Chapel Hill's police department, but I think it's fair to say every police agency in Orange County has been very committed to that larger idea of community policing. How do you, or do you, continue moving forward with that kind of philosophy in mind while simultaneously doing what's necessary to address that that very real problem?
I think it's a really good question. I think, you know, if you put 10 police leaders in a room and ask them to define community policing, you'll get a dozen examples of what they think it is. So,
because eight of them don't say anything wrong.
Right. So it varies widely, and I think it is informed by what communities ask for and expect. And sometimes it absolutely is what Anna said, is there's a neighborhood that there is a sense that it needs more police activity, and sometimes that's requested by some of the residents. Sometimes it's self-dispatched. I think that's part of these important community discussions, and it really does come back to what did the data tell us? Where is the crime really happening? What do community members want from us? One thing I think is really important, and what we do when we get there is on us, and it's really important for us to police ourselves and to use that body camera information and to respond to complaints and make sure we're delivering the highest quality service we can. I want to take one step back, though, and say an important part of our community discussion is also around how do we use police services to begin with, and Anna touched on this. You know, I have to tell you, an ugly truth in this community is there are plenty of neighborhoods that will call 911 as soon as a person of color walks down the sidewalk. That happens today in our community. Now, again, what we do when we arrive is on us, and that's for us to make sure we handle appropriately, and I'm very proud of how our folks handle that. We rarely go to that call if that's all it is, by the way. But the point is, that's a one-step removed discussion that communities need to be having. It does very much feed into that historical use of police in the sense that police are used to keep certain portions of our community down. Some elements of that persist even in our community today.
You all jump in on this?
Yeah, I think, we talked about, once you get there, that's on us, and making sure that even the department is policing themselves too. So for me, that means that these reforms aren't just a one-time thing, that they are ongoing, and this accountability and data searching and data evaluation is not something that just happens now, but something that continues to happen. And like I was saying before, the continued input from those communities, from those black and brown communities, and the people who are most affected by policing seems essential in that.
Yeah. Speaking with Emil Charles, Anna Richards, Chapel Hill Police Chief Chris Blue, we've got to start wrapping up because we're almost on the end of the half hour. This always flies. But as we get to the end of the half hour, what are you hoping to see coming out of 2020, heading into 2021, when we have this exact same topic conversation in a year? What do you want to be able to say 12 months from now, Emil?
Yeah, I think that systemic racism is something that for me needs to be addressed, and that I hope. And I know that's not something that we come back in a year, we will say that is fully addressed. Mm-hmm. But I would love to see this community and this town and take the steps necessary to address that, and making sure that the first step is certainly acknowledging that. And I think a number of people have done that, and I think many members of the community have done that. But making sure that everyone understands that issue and understands who it affects, how it affects them, and then understanding how that relates to, like Anna said, the history of policing in this country and how that can change.
Chief Blue?
Yeah, a couple things. One, we've made reference a couple times to our council's action over the summer that included establishing a task force to really take a look at what community safety means here to begin with. And it's a lot of things, not just policing. And so I encourage folks to seek opportunities to support that group's work and to be heard and to make sure they're hearing from everybody in our community. And it's a really well-assembled group, one of the best community task forces I've ever seen in terms of makeup. The other thing I would say, and I hope our community will help us with this too, is I'm very proud of our profession. I'm very proud of our department, and it is good, important work. And what it ultimately looks like is informed by the people who we serve. But I also will say that I really want our community's help in making our department the most desirable police department that you could find anywhere. Because if we're going to continue this good work, we got to have good inputs coming in the door. And we need our community support and assistance in doing that, too.
Honor Richards.
Well, I would hope a couple of things. I would hope that the community really comes together to understand and make a different decision about people with guns in our schools. A year from now, I would hope that we would have a accountability model that we can serve up in Orange and Chatham counties, and that we have ongoing dialogue. I'm hoping for some change coming out of the legislature that has more encouragement for citizen boards, whether, you know, that's an advisory board or a board that has more visibility, transparency, and activism across all our communities. And I think that what we have a year from now, I hope, are some structures that undergird this ongoing process, and so that it's not just activities that are going on right now, but that we have some structural change in how we make our communities safe that goes forward and has the potential to make some real change.
And that wraps up the first half hour of our conversation on public safety and social justice. We'll have three more special guests coming in the studio in just a few minutes, so hang out with us as we take this quick break. But much more to say on this topic as we continue and as we wrap up this final hour of the Forum on the Hill. Emile Charles, Chris Blue, Honor Richards, thank you all so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks.
Good to be here.
Thanks.
Coming back with more as the Forum on the Hill continues after this on 97.9 The Hill.
Stay tuned for more community conversations with the Forum on the Hill, sponsored by the Orange County Arts Commission, Orange County Visitors Bureau, and UNC Health. Only on 97.9 The Hill and chapelboro.com.
At UNC Health, we're experts in primary care and caring. Our specialists don't just see a condition. We see you, the whole you, mind and body. Because when we know you better, we're better at getting you well and keeping you well. And with more experts in each office, same-day appointments, and more urgent care centers, it's no wonder it's the better way of primary caring. Find the right provider for you and your family at uncprimarycare.org.
Hi, I'm Katie Murray, director of the Orange County Arts Commission. Did you know that the creative industry is the fourth largest employer in Orange County? This is thanks in large part to the many visual artists who call Orange County home.
I'm Elaine O'Neill. Each year I work with local arts organizations and my fellow visual artists to support the thriving arts community of Orange County.
The arts industry has been decimated by the pandemic. The future character and vibrancy of our community relies on our support of this critical industry. Donate to the Orange County Arts Support Fund today at artsorange.org/supportfund.
I'm Aubrey Williams, general manager of 97.9 The Hill, where we are gearing up for a new year and some fresh and compelling programming. January 4th, set your morning alarm and tune in for something new and great.
Hey, it's Aaron Keck, and I'm really excited to start waking up with you every weekday morning from 6 to 9 for This Morning with Aaron Keck. Join me and Victor Lewis as we get you going with local news and sports, great music, fun conversations, informative topics, and everything else you need to start your day right here on The Hill.
And for your afternoon drive, catch up on all the latest from our news team.
Join me, News Director Brighton McConnell, later in the day. Learn about daily headlines and developing stories from around our community during News on the Hill with Brighton McConnell. We'll have traffic and weather updates, interviews, music, and much more to keep you informed. Live from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. every weekday.
Bringing you local news and information on the air and online. 97.9 The Hill and chapelboro.com. Proud to be your hometown radio station.
Hi, it's Lori Policelli with the Chapel Hill Orange County Visitor Bureau. The holidays might look a little different this year with masks and social distancing, but the spirit of giving and love is alive and well in Orange County. Remember to support your friends and neighbors who own retail shops in Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and Hillsborough. Your gift to your loved ones will also be a gift to one of our hardworking local businesses. Let's all get out and give back this season.
They say singing can help you remember things, so here's some tips for parents out there during these tough times.
Number one.
Make sure your kids wash their hands for 20 seconds after they've coughed or sneezed or been outside.
Two.
Virtual play dates, social and physical distancing can help save lives.
Three.
Tell them they're safe and show your love and pride. Yes, we'll get through this together. Find out more at coronavirus.gov. A message from the CDC and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Community Conversations on the Forum on the Hill. Presented by the Orange County Arts Commission, Orange County Visitors Bureau, and UNC Health. Hear the full conversation and catch anything you miss at chapelboro.com/forumonthehill.
And welcome back to the Forum on the Hill. Aaron Keck here with you at 97.9 The Hill Studios, beginning to wrap up the forum because we are in the final half hour of the final hour of this forum. So thanks again to all of the sponsors for all of the many people who have been in this studio throughout the week sharing their thoughts and insights and knowledge and expertise about the issues affecting our community. We're not done, though. We are halfway through our hour on public safety and social justice, and we are joined in the studio by three more special guests who are going to bring us home. Charles Blackwood is the sheriff of Orange County, Clarence Burkhead is the sheriff of Durham County, and Kevin Causey Thomas is the host of Inside Voices here on 97.9 The Hill, owner of Vibe House 405. You have like 15 titles. What is on your business card?
Multi-hyphenated creative.
There you go. Multi-hyphenated creative and the host of Inside Voices here on 97.9 The Hill. So Sheriff Causey, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
So we're going to pick up the conversation where we left off in the last half hour. But before we do, I want to turn to the sheriffs, Blackwood and Burkhead, and ask you about the other very large thing that's happened in 2020 that we actually haven't really talked about so much this hour, which is COVID-19 and its impact. How has that affected not just your daily, everyday activity and staying safe and keeping yourselves and your staff safe, but how is it impacting just the community at large in terms of what you're seeing, the calls are coming in, or the things you're responding to?
So here in Orange County, and not unlike all the sheriffs in the state, we recognize the fact that our personnel represent a small portion of the county who are responsible for taking care of all the county. Because they are specially trained and specialized and certified in the duties that they perform, we don't have backfill for those people. So should they become ill, I don't have anybody that I can put in their place. So it became imperative that, and really mission critical, that we take care of our staff. The other component of that is our detention center. Our residents within that detention center are they're captive, of course, by the very nature of what we do. It became also mission critical for us to protect them. And so immediately I stopped visitation by in person, and we created some video visitation for attorneys and family members. We made exceptions if there was an emergency. We also shut down our federal program so that the federal inmates quit coming in, because I want to be sure that who's there is stabilized and healthy, and our medical staff takes care of them on a daily basis. I had a company come in and construct two negative pressure rooms so we don't have air circulating through the whole facility from our isolation areas. And when you come in, you have to be held in that isolation area for a certain amount of days before you can go into general population. The same thing goes for folks that are transferred from one unit to another. That unit will isolate those folks before they bring them to us, and we do the same before we take them to them. But the main thing was we had to take care of our personnel and those that we were entrusted to protect in our facilities. The other thing is that we've noticed is that people are getting worn out. They're getting tired. Our domestics have gone up. Our suicides have gone up. And just the rate of frustration that's felt everywhere. You know, there's the mask mandate. I've made a decision in my county that I want to instruct people that it's important, but we're not enforcing it to the point that I'm going to arrest anybody unless it becomes an immediate health issue and public safety issue, which it has not. And so that's, I think that we're operating basically like everyone else is throughout the state.
Mm-hmm. Sheriff Burkhead?
Yeah, I would just echo what Sheriff Blackwood has said, because we operate in the same manner. the detention center very quickly became a priority. And secondary to that, and not in, in sense of priority, but the things that we had to do, with, like he said, just take care of our people. And because we are operating 24/7. And I, unfortunately, I've had detention officers impacted by COVID. I've had LEOs impacted by COVID, either directly or their family. And it has taken a toll on us. And so we've had to shut down some training opportunities from time to time, close the office, telework, just like everyone else. But at the end of the day, we must serve our citizens. So the deputies are out responding to calls. Civil papers need to be served. We just need to continue to do the business of the sheriff's office, but we're doing it a little bit differently. And like as far as enforcement, yeah, our approach immediately became encourage, educate, and enforce as a last resort. We want people to follow the orders, but we also, we know that we don't have the personnel or the capacity to enforce this on like we would any other traffic law or anything else. So we've had to adjust.
Well, that's from the law enforcement perspective. Kazi Thomas, over to you, and trying to get the conversation back to picking up where we left off in the last half hour. COVID-19 has had an impact on everything, and certainly the racial justice movement is no exception to this. We've had kind of the same line that's kept coming back over the course of this week, which is that whatever existed before COVID-19 has enhanced it or made it more prominent or larger or more extreme. So if there are disparities before that need to be addressed, COVID-19 has enhanced those and made those disparities even larger. So how does that impact the racial justice movement right now?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I'd like to, you know, salute both of the sheriffs here for at least, you know, addressing, you know, the fact that COVID is, you know, a serious thing that's affecting the jail and prison population, you know, as even the workers as well, right? Because what we don't want is someone that's serving their time for a crime that they did commit to end up being having a death sentence by, you know, where they are in a jail or a holding facility and now falling victim to COVID-19, you know, because like you said, the same disparities that we see along economic, educational, racial lines, and what we're seeing in our communities of people that don't have insurance, that don't have medical attention, you know, that can afford the type of medical attention that that comes along with, you know, having insurance to have for a hospital stay, you know, and when we're talking about like, you know, who it's affecting, Black and Brown, you know, people, you know, my mother's 86, so I can't, you know, the fact that a certain part of the population won't get it, and that they could expose it to me, and then I could expose it to my 86-year-old mother, right? Mm-hmm. Or that someone could be, like I said, in a community that's affected by it, that's not being addressed. And so on top of that, you know, when you're talking about if you don't have a job, you're battling a pandemic, or if you do have a job and you still have to go to work and you're battling a pandemic, how those factors affect you and in this movement, at the same time, you feel like it's another, you have a virus on top of everything else that you are already facing. And so for the people that can't speak for themselves that are locked up in these cells, for these sheriffs to say that, hey, we're paying attention to that and at least trying to address it is super important. And I hope they continue to do so.
So getting to a question that we discussed in the last half hour, 1,000 different possible reforms are on the table right now that are being discussed. What do you see as being the most effective or the most necessary, and which ones do you see as being kind of red herrings, as it were, like things that are being talked about but may not be effective?
Well, yeah, I'll start first.
Yeah.
We've heard a lot, and Sheriff Blackwood and I sit in meetings. We're both obviously on the Sheriff's Association. He serves on the executive committee. And very early on, you know, we heard the rallying cry, which was defund the police. Mm. And so what I tried to do is really get out in front of that and let's drill down and understand what you're really asking for. Because defunding the police, my humble opinion, is unrealistic. And should we do something different? Absolutely. When I ran for office in 2018, I ran on a platform of criminal justice reform. And what that means is we need to make change. And in order for us to do that, we have to self-examine. And when I say us, I'm talking about every facet of the criminal legal system. We haven't achieved justice yet. I heard a colleague of mine from Minnesota refer to it as the criminal legal system because we have not achieved justice. So we have to self-examine, and what we're doing at the Sheriff's Association, we put forth a proposal, and one of your guests in the last half hour mentioned it, and I'm very proud of the work that the sheriffs in North Carolina have done to this point to recognize that we need to change. And being 100 sheriffs, we're strong. And we have an opportunity to really influence policy and professionalism in law enforcement as we move forward to really address these issues, whether it's through accountability, policy changes, or legislative proposals and changes, whatever the case may be. We need a seat at the table to have a conversation with our community members, because it's not about us, it's about the community, and everyone has to be in the conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that what I would say was important is the continued transparency in the conversation, right? I know that we have, body cams here in North Carolina, but there is some restrictions on access to that. And I think that does, that's legislative. I can't put that on the sheriff or the police department, that something that's put there to create transparency is now super hard for us to access and see and gain that transparency. So conversations like this are super important. I think that locally here, Durham, Orange, I feel safe here. You know what I'm saying? I think 9.99 cops out of 10 here are super positive and super solid. I want to say that and put that energy out there. But I think that when we have problems, that people are held accountable, that there's transparency. You know, I just think that those things are important for the integrity, because we want to know that that if there's somebody that does step out of line or take things in their own hands, that the sheriffs aren't cool with that either, mm-hmm. that the police department aren't cool with people in their department that are rogue or doing things that would make their department look bad or that would break the confidence of the people that we have in our law enforcement. So that accountability and that transparency, I would say, is two elements that are just super important.
How do you, this is a weird way of phrasing this question, how do you allocate resources when it comes to pushing for change? Because I teach American government, we talk about federalism, yeah, it's part of the Constitution, but the downside of it is power is diffused among so many different institutions. You got the federal, the state, the local.
Vote.
How many different
vote.
Local organizations?
Vote.
Yeah.
Vote.
When it comes to that, voting number one. What else do you do in terms of this agency can do this, which is limited, but you can have an easier conversation. This level can do a lot more, but it's very intransigent. How do you react?
This is my two cent, and I don't speak for all Black people or anybody or anything like that. I think that our law enforcement is being asked to do a lot of things that are outside of their job description. I think they're being asked to pull up sometimes on mental health situations, domestic situations, just situations where it's like they're being asked to do a lot in an intense moment and in a short amount of time. And I'm not here to make excuse for that, because I do understand, the people's perspective on it if this is your job. But at the same time, we're talking about defund. We saw a big kind of conflict going. People even had a problem with Obama and his view on it in the last week. I would say that I'm not anti-police. What I am is pro, if we, to take the money and say that, hey, instead of asking our cops to show up and be mental health care workers, that maybe some of that money is allocated towards a group of people that show up and handle that don't put that pressure on them, or that there are ways that the budgets and things without totally, disenfranchising our police force, that we say that we do feel it's important to allocate money into other things that are equally as important. I don't think you have to be anti to be pro, if that makes sense at all.
Yeah.
And so I think that sometimes when you hear defund the police, it is a red flag. It does sound, I think a lot of times for some people, it does hit their ear the wrong way, when I would be more for the conversation of like, how can we allocate funds towards the things that we need that wouldn't ask them to do so much?
Well, I'm glad you said that, because Sheriff Blackwood, the last time you and I were in the same room together, we were talking about the Reentry Council.
Yeah, we've been doing this for 15 years.
Yeah,
we started reallocating funds years ago when we started family treatment court, drug treatment court, teen court. And there's a gambit of things. I got to go back and say, too, that COVID, not just COVID, but the social justice issues, you know, with George Floyd and all the things that came about, created, and I hate to even say this, but it was almost a silver lining in the black cloud, or the cloud, if you will, that now the eyes are focused solely on the criminal justice system. And I think it's a sustained focus, you're right? It didn't just happen and go away. This ain't going away. And if law enforcement leaders don't recognize that, one, you've got to have this dialogue. Two, you got to not just talk the talk. You've got to walk the walk, and you have to develop strategies to make certain very important changes. And we have done that in North Carolina. And I got to say this too: if we're looking for a county, or if we're looking for a region to change, to wholesale change, this probably ain't the one you want to change, because we're doing some really good stuff here. Even though we haven't hit the perfect we hadn't got to where we want to be. Clarence mentioned, Sheriff mentioned a minute ago, the basic pretense of Palian principles is you got to listen to your community. And Chris Blue mentioned it earlier, you have to have a contract. You get a contract when you go buy a house or a car. But we're talking about protecting the public. If a law enforcement leader doesn't have a contract or an understanding with their community, then they might as well pack up and go home. So the eyes are on us. The detention population, our residents within our detention centers, we took our average daily population before COVID from 136 to now 73 for our average daily population. And some of those practices that we're doing to reduce that number. And I got to say this, too, for all the folks who are out there saying, Sheriff, why are you letting them out of jail? Sheriffs don't put people in jail. Sheriffs don't let people out of jail. Judges do. So, and I got to say that, because there's a lot of people that are out there that are ticked off saying, you know, Sheriff, you need to quit letting that guy out of jail. We're frustrated when they hit the streets, too. If they don't need to be in jail, they need to be out of jail. Punishment is intended to begin at conviction, not at arrest. And if we accept that fact, and quit thinking a bond is something to punish somebody and keep them in jail forever, or keep them where they can't be with their families, we'll get to that better place. My point is, we've got people that need to be back at work with their families doing what they do if they're in there for writing a bad check. Mm-hmm. If you've got somebody that absolutely needs to be kept out of the community, by all means, and that's what the judges do. They say, no, you can't get out, or yes, you can get out. But that is not the sheriff's doing that. My original statement about reducing the populations comes from the fact that for the first time in a very long time, all the court stakeholders are working together to create efficient movement of our cases so people don't have to sit in jail. We had a young man who was 19 years old. He was caught with less than a half an ounce. He couldn't make his bond. He stayed in jail for 115 days. Mm-hmm. He couldn't have gotten that much if he was found guilty day one. Mm-hmm. So we got to figure out how to better manage the population we have, and we're doing that now. Accountability, that's one of the things we talked about voting earlier. Accountability happens every day. It doesn't happen at election time. Who puts people in jails? That's judges. We know that now. The Palian principles, body cameras, and I'm glad that, you know, Kevin mentioned that. The new legislation that came out about body cams talks about how you can obtain or view that information. It's really, really important to remember that while you have to have a judge's order, a lot of times all you got to do is walk into that law enforcement agency and say, hey, I want to look at the video. And they'll let you look at it if you're in that video. If you're not in that video, privacy issues protect the people in that video. You really don't need to be looking at it. If you feel that something was done criminally and that, tell the DA can release it if they want to. So there is a mechanism to get it out there. And a lot of people who are not in the criminal justice world don't clearly understand that. And it's a fair point. And that's why these conversations are so terribly important, right? I don't want to hog all the time, but I'm passionate about what we do, and I want to make it better.
And I do want to get back to just to clarify the reduction of the jail population from 140 down to 70. That a lot of that was motivated by, oh, COVID, we need to reduce the population, but that lasts after COVID, right?
So it was about COVID, but immediately it became apparent to us that we were doing our work so much more efficiently within the courts. And, you know, when you talk about the criminal justice system, I go back to my Plinko thing. you watch the Plinko game on The Price is Right. You drop a chip in and it hits a bunch of nails and drops out the bottom. That is the criminal justice system. The cops ain't the only ones in there. There are judges, there's lawyers, there's courts, there's magistrates, there's counselors, and that chip drops out at the bottom, and it is what it is. But we are at least the second peg that it touches, because the first is a lot of time the 911 caller, right? Mm-hmm. But we got to understand that criminal justice system is made up of a lot of moving parts and a lot of people, and we got to work with all of them. And right now, we're all working together, at least in Orange, Durham, Chatham. We're really working tightly together now to make positive change, and it's going to last.
Kevin, you were nodding through a lot of that, but you were snapping at bond reform.
Know, the sheriff is talking about is positive and it's constructive, and it's good to hear law enforcement speak in that way. And I think this is what we're talking about is two people that are elected, right? And so it matters what they think about, all of these things, that, perspective. This is the difference between someone that feels this way and someone that doesn't. And when we're talking about what can happen here in Durham and Chapel Hill and Orange and Wake County, what goes on nationally, this could be the exception. Like Sheriff said, there's some things that they, if we've already working on it, it's like the conversation, if you stay ready, you don't have to get ready. Mm-hmm. And they're already working, having these conversations. I already have been talking to Chief Blue, had Chief Blue on my podcast, right? Mm-hmm. And so these conversations were already going on. And I think that constructive ones like these is where we get somewhere.
We're getting close to the end of the hour, and I want to give you all a chance to wrap up. So final thoughts, final takeaways as we head into 2021. What are you hopeful for? What are you worried about? Sheriff Brookhead.
No, absolutely. And I really hate we have to end this conversation. This is fantastic. And let me just say I'm willing to come back anytime, and certainly Kevin Kazzy will be on the show anytime. But what I'm worried about is what was mentioned earlier a little bit. People are getting sort of punch drunk on COVID, and they're letting their guard down. We cannot afford to let our guard down. So we have to continue to battle this pandemic as we battle this criminal pandemic that we're dealing with, particularly in Durham. I can talk about my jurisdiction. Our gun violence is off the charts. Mm-hmm. We have to address it. And to Sheriff Blackwood's point, in order for us to create real change in this system we refer to as criminal justice, all of us have to be involved. From the judges, certainly the prosecutors. The prosecutor is key to the success of what we do every day, is trying to identify those characters who commit the violent offenses, apprehend them, and prepare a case so that the prosecutor can do their job for criminal conviction. We're not out here chasing folks for dealing nickel bags and weed and low-level offense. That's not what we're about. But we are about safety, and we're all about keeping our community safe. But it takes all of us, and it's already been mentioned. My population is down, not quite as low as Sheriff Black was. I wish it was. But I'm worried that as this pandemic lingers on into 2021, we're going to see a spike, continue to see a spike in crime.
Sheriff Blackwood.
Yeah, real quick, I'll just say that, we got a lot of things to think about going forward into 21. It's not going to go away on the new year. I want us to also remember that it's critical that I be passionate about my staff and the men and women that wear the badge in Orange County, whether they be Chapel Hill or troopers or Carver or campus or whoever. Somebody's going to wear the badge, right? And I want it to be the best and the brightest. And we got to lighten up on our people just a little bit, because right now our guys are feeling they're vilified, not just by some people, but from of our legislators and some of our government officials in Raleigh. We're the villains, and we haven't done anything wrong, and we're trying to get it right. And everybody I talk to, everybody wearing a badge says, man, I got 15 years and 2 days and 20 minutes left, or I got 5 years, and they're looking to go. I got law enforcement leaders that are talking about getting out of the business wholesale going. And we don't need that. We need the best and the brightest here taking care of our people. And I think we can make some positive change. We've just got to continue the dialogue with people like Kevin, Clarence, and Anna Richards, who just left. Mm-hmm. We just spoke this week, and healthy dialogue going on.
Kathy Thomas, final
absolutely. Word. Yeah, I just want to appreciate that this type of conversation is ongoing. because it's starting to be less and less headline news on CNN and Fox and everywhere, right? And then it fades away, and then the conversation goes away, and then my son is sitting here when he's my age having the same conversation, different hashtag, different name, right? And so I think that in this moment in time, we're trying to not let the energy of what was positive happen in March and April get away, that people that are about what's constructively can come out on the other side of this, good cops and good people, that can come together and have this conversation. Because in much the way that I hate that law enforcement has been vilified in this moment, many people of color and African Americans would say the same, that they feel like that they have been classified as the perp in this dialogue for the last forever, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that these conversations now, if we all said enough in both directions, I think we're gonna get somewhere. I think, like I said, Orange and Durham has a lot of great things going for it in this conversation. Wake needs to catch up, I feel. I'm going to be honest, but I feel like Orange and Durham are leading the way on this conversation. I'm proud to be a part of it.
And that wraps up our conversation on public safety and social justice. Sheriff Charles Blackwood, Sheriff Clarence Burkhead, Kevin Causey-Thomas, thank you all so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to all of the sponsors, all of the special guests, all of the people working behind the scenes to make the Forum on the Hill possible. Revisit the whole thing on our website, chapelboro.com. That is going to do it for this hour. We are going to continue the show coming up in just a few minutes with Live and Local after this.
Thanks for listening to Community Conversations on the Forum on the Hill, presented by the Orange County Arts Commission, Orange County Visitors Bureau, and UNC Health. Join us tomorrow at 4 p.m. to hear more discussions by local leaders on community-wide issues. See the full schedule of forum topics by day and catch up on anything you missed at chapelboro.com/forumonthehill.